What's that, Monday already? Oh my gosh, what happened to the weekend? It was daylight saving time this weekend. Hey everybody, I'm Larry Jacobs. It is the 15th of March. Is that the Ides of March? I think it is. I'll have to ask my good friend Pat. He'll be on in just a second. 2021, almost said 2015. Why? Because it's March 15th. Don't ask me why. It's Monday morning. So Pat's going to wake me and you up with a great show today. Pat's from the Driving Force Institute for Public Engagement. Great friend of ours. He's the CEO over there, and he's going to be talking about teaching history in a post-Trump administration world. We were all scared to do it a little bit. We were iffy, that sort of thing. Let's see what's going on, what's controversial. What is it that we have from a good source, Pat Ricards of the Driving Force Institute, again, for public engagement. This show is going to be archived over at ace-ed.org. That's ace-ed.org, ace-ed.org. That's our American Consortium for Equity and Education. We invite you to join with us over there if you want to. It's all free. Our magazine, Equity and Access, is over there. Really great. You'll really enjoy it. It's right there. It's an online journal. Just flip right through. Enjoy the articles on our podcasts are over there, et cetera, et cetera. Everything all about equity and access over at ace-ed.org in pre-K-12 education. I think I forgot to introduce myself. My name is Larry Jacobs, and welcome to today's show. Okay, did I forget to introduce myself? Pat, you're spinning here. Hold on. There you go. Did I forget to introduce myself, Pat?
You did. You're so excited to talk about the Ides of March, Larry, that you forgot to let us know who you are.
I am. I'm worried. My wife was getting out 22 knives this morning. I'm very concerned. She said she was going to wash them. Okay? very concerned. I'm wearing, she made me wear a toga for some reason. I don't know what's going on around here. But it is the Ides of March today. Wow. Julius Caesar, beware. Okay? I saw a funny meme, Pap. It had a Julius Caesar, a Caesar salad with knives stuck in it. That was pretty funny. Okay. How you doing, my friend? How's everything?
I'm good. Very good. How are you today?
I'm fine. Just waking up from the weekend where we had to lose the hour's sleep. Okay? Did you turn your clocks ahead?
Most
Obviously
of them, yes.
Did.
The one thing I haven't touched is the clock on my wife's nightstand. That's her business.
Wow. She's still sleeping late? She thinks it's, what, 8 o'clock now?
No, she's still up, but it still is an hour behind at this point.
Oh, okay. Good. Well, that gives her more time in the day to get things done. We'll just let that one go. All right. Tell everybody about your Driving Force Institute, which I just love.
Well, I appreciate it. What we're doing is really trying to figure out how we can make the teaching and learning of history more interesting and more relevant.
Yeah.
I think that, so much of what we know about history, today's learners, particularly those in high school, just find boring. And we're trying to reverse that trend, trying to show them this is interesting and important to both there today and there tomorrow.
Yeah, and why do they find it? Well, I don't know. Some kids always found it boring, but I think you can't know till where you're going until you know where you've been. As me, and I'm an old history teacher, I always found it fascinating. All right, but you think kids are inundated with news 24/7, just like we are? They may not realize it, but they're bombarded just like we are. And what happened in the past is less relevant than what's going on in the future with a 24/7 bombardment. What do you think of that?
Well, I think for today's young people, it really comes down to two things. One, they don't see how history is relevant to them getting a job, earning a living, taking care of a family. Their future history, the past is not relevant. And so we don't do a good job of explaining all of the wonderful skills one gets when you're studying history. But I think, more importantly,
like that,
I think where it really comes down to, we've now got a student body in K-12 across the United States that is less homogeneous than it has ever been. And for the most part, we still teach history. Until you get through, February of a school year, everything you learn about is about dead white male landowners. You get yourself through the Civil War by February.
Yeah.
You learn about the same two or three African-American leaders every February as part of Black History Month. It doesn't seem relevant. It's not. I mean, how can one relate when you don't see yourself in that history? You don't see an awful lot about the role women played during both the Revolution and the Civil War. You obviously don't see what people of color were doing. That makes it harder for kids to care. And I would add, the third point, it's the way we teach it. I mean, it might work for, generations past where you gave them a big dusty textbook and said, here, go at it, read chapters 2 and 3 tonight.
Yeah, right.
That's not the way it is. And when you look at today's, you know, Generation Z, Generation Alphas, they're getting their news off of TikTok, Larry. They're not getting their news off of CNN.
I know. Yeah, I know. Go ahead, please. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
No. And so I think, you know, it just changed. It's how we present that news. When you look at, you know, the average young person, if they're spending time on YouTube, they're getting no more of 2 minutes of their time on an individual segment. If you're on TikTok, you're getting far less than that. And so that means, you know, you can't sit down and read a chapter in a book. You certainly can't expect them to watch a Ken Burns documentary if you want them to understand history.
Right. You can't. So what do we do with that case? And actually, this brings up a good point. If what you're saying is accurate, what's changing out there in the teaching of history? Are we relating to the kids the way they see the world today, the way they ingest information? Are we doing a half-decent job of that?
I think you have some teachers that are. Some teachers have risen to the occasion. I think others feel that they're limited in terms of what their district can let them do, in terms of what their teacher education prepared them to do. I always like to flip the question, Larry, that it's not about how do we improve the teaching of history, it's how do we improve the learning of history.
That's a good we're on the same wavelength there, my friend. We're on the same wavelength.
Yeah,
should it be more interdisciplinary than it is?
I think it could be, but I think it's also, it's relating just as you were talking earlier, I think you were dead on it, because how do you begin to engage students, engage learners in ways that they're already being engaged?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that's why, you know, when you start looking at multimedia, for instance, you know, I spent a lot of time as we were launching Driving Force Institute talking with high school students across the country. And, you know, we talked to them about, you know, how their teachers were using video games, how they were using quizzes, how they were using graphic novels, videos, those sorts of things to try to make history a little more interesting. And, you know, the learners really have a great sense of this stuff. And, you know, I would talk to them, and they could see teachers wanted to engage them on their own terms. And they would talk about, you know, so some teachers would try to use videos they found on the internet, and they were really bad videos, but it's better than nothing. You had others, and I talked to teachers that were doing this too. And, you know, students would notice, you know, there were some teachers that would decide to use drunken history and would spend hours editing out the alcohol and editing out the curse words to use it in the classroom. And the kids appreciated that. But that's one of those things, you know, for the average teacher to spend 3 or 4 hours editing a video that they'll spend 3 minutes watching in class, that's not tenable for an educator. So I think it really becomes, you know, I don't think we've talked about this, but I was part of an initiative years ago where we were working with existing social studies teachers. We were providing a professional development program. And what we were doing is we were teaching them game theory, not how do you design a video game, but how do you do things like a trivia game, an escape room, a board game around history to make it a little more interesting. And, you know, when all of a sudden you see, and there's one that still has never left me. This was a school district in Massachusetts, and this teacher had decided to do an escape room that was based on state and local history around the American Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And you saw students that were completely engaged. They loved what they were doing. They were having fun with the added benefit of learning along the way.
Yeah. You know, years ago when I was teaching, okay, years ago, I used my the bulletin board that took up the whole back of the room. Okay, and we created for immigration, we did a big board game up there. Okay, each section I had did a different one, and it was a board game where you move pieces around, how to jump over obstacles, etc. And I remember the kids really loved that. They became engaged in it, okay, because it was their creation, but they were using all the things they learned to create something. Not that I'm bragging about the great things I did. That's not my point, okay? My point is that if you can engage these kids, it really does. And today, the attention span is less, okay? And that seems to me to be the challenge. And also, and because of that, okay, and you brought up an interesting question when we were planning that show. I just want to go into this, okay? I'm going to say this now. This is your question you wanted me to ask. We're now renaming schools based on past acts. removing names like Washington and Lincoln. Okay, to me, that's a very shallow look at history. Okay, you look at it from your point of view, from just what you have now. Okay, and you can't do that. And I'm wondering where we are on that type of scale these days, when everything has to be instantaneous. Okay, and a decision has to be made instantaneously based on now. Okay, when we talk about engaging kids, we can't just engage them in the now. We have to give them a perspective. Okay, what are your thoughts on that? With the school, changing the school names, et cetera.
Absolutely correct. I think it becomes incredibly dangerous when we start evaluating history based on the perspectives of the now. Because I mean, it doesn't matter. You're talking about U.S. history, world history, whatever it is. History is very complex. It's very complicated, and it's very dark. You know, there are incredible highs and lows, and you know it's one of those that
and an awful lot of lows.
Have to take the
awful lot of lows.
But we have to understand that. I think you know that is why history becomes so important. When you look at it, this is not about you know, how do I know enough history so that I can be really smart during bar night trivia. History, this is about teaching us all to think like historians, to ask questions, to push back, you know, to really probe, to work with others, to have those discussions, to, you know, that's what we're trying to strive for here. And, you know, yes, it becomes very easy to say that there should be no public school building that was named after an individual who once held slaves. It's far more important as we learn our history, though. You know, to understand an individual like George Washington, not just what he did in terms of the American Revolution, not just what he did in terms of our first president, but to understand, yes, he was one of the largest slave owners in Virginia. And that, yes, he saw by the end of his life, he had concerns about that and freed all of his slaves upon his death. Those become important pieces. You know, it becomes important to understand, yes, Abraham Lincoln did incredible work as in leading this country through the Civil War. There is value to understanding some of the questionable things he said on the campaign trail to get to the White House in the first place. That becomes an important thing. You know, you look, even if you move to modern history, you know, you look at somebody like a Lyndon Johnson who did, you know, Rights Act was passed by Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon Johnson said very, very questionable things throughout his entire life.
Absolutely.
About race.
Texas Southerner, Southern Texas, a man from South Texas. Yep, Texas Hills.
Yeah, and it's one of those, I recognize, and it's maybe getting a little bit off the point of what you're talking about.
Yeah,
you know, we're now engaged in this cancel culture. You know,
it's crazy.
People are doing or saying things in the now that don't agree with where we believe our social mores are. We want to eliminate them from that. That's, and I understand that. But you can't go back in history and do it.
Yeah, I understand the emotion
that
of it. I do understand the emotion of it, but and I agree with you. You have to go deeper to understand what it's all about. Okay, you have to go deeper and put it into a perspective. And that's actually what history is. It's a perspective. Okay? It allows you to see today. Go ahead, Beth.
I think one of the best examples of that, you know, you look at, I know they've got one that they removed in Boston, they still kept it in D.C., is you have the statue of Abraham Lincoln with the freed slave. And yes, it can be a disturbing image when you see a slave, you know, breaking from his chains on his knees before Lincoln. But if you want to teach the real history, it's not that we have to take that statue and put it in a box and lock it up like we did the Ark of the Covenant in Indiana Jones. But why not take the time to teach what Frederick Douglass said at the unveiling of that statue in Washington, D.C., where he spoke incredibly eloquently about the ugliness of American history and the work ahead of us?
Yeah. Yeah, it is absolutely amazing. It is the good, the bad, and the ugly. I hate to use Sergio Leone's movies, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. We got to teach it all. We got to teach it all, and that's all there is to it, and understand where we are, et cetera. There's all kinds of perspective out there, which brings me to another thing you wanted to talk about, okay? And by the way, I just want to say, give everybody the Driving Force Institute website. I don't have it here on my sheet of paper. Just want to make
sure.
Sure.
So our website is drivingforceinstitute.org. But if you want to just get right to the videos we've been producing, we've now got 150 short films, animated short films about untold moments in history. You can find that at untoldhistory.org.
Thank you very much. I just want to make sure we got that out there because this is really, really great stuff. You know, speaking of a perspective of history, the New York Times and a whole bunch of historians worked on the 1619 Project, okay, because 2 years ago we were able to look at the year the first slaves came to America. Okay, pretty sad stuff, I got to tell you. All right, and you look at that and you go through that. And then the Donald Trump administration came up with the 1776 Commission. Okay, and that was to look at through different eyes. All right, talk about that if you wish, because there are perspectives there, but we have to talk
there
about
are.
This. Go ahead. Yeah.
There are, and I think it becomes important that we're looking at all of those perspectives, quite honestly. And, you know, I can tell you that, you know, when we started Untold History, you know, we have a video segment where we sat down with Nicole Hannah-Jones, who was responsible for creating 1619 for the New York Times, and talked to her about the significance of the project, and we talked to her about the significance of 1619. It's enormously important because it's not, you know, when we talk about the history that's taught in those dusty textbooks, 1619 is not something that is overly emphasized. It's not a part of our history that we really discuss. But at the same time, I think it doesn't mean just because one sees the value of 1619, just because, and you're seeing it in some states and school districts across the country where they're adopting the 1619 curriculum. There's value to doing that in your classroom. There's value to showing those perspectives and tell those stories that, you know, the average high school junior or senior never learned previously. But that doesn't mean that we need to eliminate the history that we were learning in 1776.
Bingo.
And I think that if you look at the report, and I think it's hard to find the report that the Trump administration released because they, I think, released it the day before the inauguration, and the next day the incoming Biden administration wiped it off of the servers.
Yeah.
But if you go to Hillsdale College, the report is still on their website, and because their president was the chairman of it. And there it also, I think it's got a very clear perspective on what the commission, the 1776 commission, was trying to do. It's not a curriculum. You know, it is, you know, those who believe that, you know, the founding fathers and the founding documents like the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution are essential learning for understanding our nation and learning our history and our government. Again, there's nothing wrong with that either. I think it really, you know, it falls to all of the great social studies teachers we have to really understand how do you synthesize the two? You know, how do you use these as a discussion point for your classes? That it's not pick one or the other.
Right.
But really, you know, having those discussions, having those debates on the merits and understanding, you know, how much is the nation truly at, you know, the starting nation truly understood what was happening in 1619? You know, understanding in 1776, as you know, you had Thomas Jefferson writing the Declaration of Independence. You know, you can go through his writings and see what that meant as a man who was a slaveholder, who did not release his slaves upon his death, but wrote that all men are created equal. You know, having those sorts of discussions become incredibly important. I don't understand how you can teach American history without acknowledging and to a degree embracing those founding ideas and those founding documents.
And at the same time, recognizing that they left out, okay, a lot of important things, okay, and they were in some ways hypocritical. And we have to look at all of that. And understand that it's that simple. But the challenge these days, okay, and I think it's even bad on college campuses, all right, is that doing that, okay, to a certain extent causes controversy in the classroom. It insults some kids. It aggravates other kids. It creates a lot of controversy. Where are we on that? I mean, and the classic example of that, you know, it's from 2016 on, okay, through to about now, Okay, teachers were really scared to teach civics mm-hmm. and modern history and bring the things up because there was so much angst and anger, okay, and emotion involved, etc. It reminds me of the old line with the Cho'em Lai when they asked him in 1970 what he thought of the outcome of the French Revolution. And that was in the 1798, and he says, too soon to tell.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the same thing.
Yep.
How controversial, how close can we get to teaching history, okay, in terms of today's crazy events? I refer, of course, to January 6th, okay, the mm-hmm. insurrection at the Capitol and all that sort of stuff, and the craziness of the last two elections. What do we do? How do we do it?
I think you're dead on. I think, you know, and you can even use the American example. You talk about the French Revolution. Remember, we came out of the Constitutional Convention, and somebody asked Benjamin Franklin, what have you given us? And his answer was a republic, if you can keep it.
That's right.
And I think that becomes our constant struggle. I would push back, Larry. I don't know if the problem is the students in the classroom as much as it is their parents.
I won't argue that. But kids are influenced by their parents. They are. Okay.
I think
the controversy, the boil over in the classroom, it may root itself out of the different place, but it erupts in the classroom. Oh, yeah. Do you want that? Okay. It's a hard thing
to
do. And again, it's you know, you need some perspective. You know, the old joke, hindsight's always 20/20. Okay. But you're right on top of this stuff now, and it's hard to teach it now. What you can teach is what went before, and there were rebellions before. Okay, and they were basically put down, the biggest one, of course, being the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you know, and it's you got to put it into a historical perspective and let kids see where it is now. But I don't know if you could actually, quote, teach this stuff now. All you could do is refer them to look back at the history of it. What do you think?
I think you have to teach it now, and I say that, you know, I think, you know, for too many teachers, and I know I've had many conversations over the last few months in particular since the 6th of January, is, you know, there is great fear. You're absolutely correct. There is great fear about pushback they will get from parents and pushback they will get from their administrators for teaching controversial subjects in their classroom. But at the same time, you know, it's one of those things that this is happening in real time. If we don't discuss it in our classrooms, we know that kids are learning it elsewhere. It has not lost on me that, you know, when the events of the 6th were unfolding, I was in my office, and all of a sudden toward the end of the day, my daughter comes in and asks me if I can help her understand more what just happened today. And I said, okay, well, where are you learning about it? She said, oh, it's all over TikTok.
Ah,
so they're getting this to begin with.
Jeez.
And they're getting it unfiltered, you know, whether it be through news or whether it be through friends. And so it falls on us to really figure out, you know, how do we talk about it in the right ways? I think you had raised the issue of interdisciplinary. I look back, you know, my mother was a high school English teacher. That's how she spent her profession. She taught 10th grade English, American literature. And journal writing was always an essential part of her classroom. And even in the most controversial of times, she would assign those topics. It was not for her. It was not about, you know, who's right and who's wrong. You know, she was using it because she wanted to make sure that her students were writing. But she also wanted to provide them that sort of outlet. And I think that, you know, again, if you look at history, not just about what happened in the past, and yes, January 6th was a wonderful opportunity to teach about all sorts of things, to teach about the fact that Samuel J. Tilden was denied the presidency despite
winning.
That's right.
You know,
all of those things that one
can teach. He won, as far as I'm concerned. He won. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think, you know, we talk – Larry, I think you've experienced this as I have. You know, if I go back to the 1990s, we talked about how important it was for kids to learn 21st century skills. Then we talked about how important it was for them to learn. Then we talk now about how important it is for them to know soft skills. The funny thing with all of this is the skills we're talking about are the same. We weren't teaching STEM to make everybody a rocket scientist or a brain surgeon. We were talking about critical thinking and collaboration and those sorts of skills that you need just to survive. Teaching modern history, teaching current events is a great way of doing that. to force students to discuss these issues that they're getting everywhere else, and force us to work together, force us to be civil in our discussions, force us to bring facts forward and not just opinions that we may have heard somewhere else. I completely understand why teachers would be reluctant to dive into these topics, because it can be incredibly scary, particularly when you have that irate parent calling the central office demanding to know, why my kid's teacher is teaching them about X, and how dare they?
That's right.
That's scary.
You said something before when you were talking about your daughter a few minutes ago, and you mm-hmm. used the word, which was interesting. They're getting all the news. I'm paraphrasing there. Quote, mm-hmm. unfiltered. That was the word you used.
Yep.
Unfiltered. Okay. Is that bad? We need to teach them how to create. Do we teach them how to create their own filters? They're getting news unfiltered. And, that was the complaint for years. I go back now to Spiro Agnew. Okay, when they started to complain about all the, quote, liberal media, well, there was only X amount of sources of media, and that, frankly, they were fairly liberal. Okay? They were. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
I think they were being honest to themselves, but it was a more liberal point of view, if I may. Okay? Which was brought up poorly, okay, and angrily, but it wasn't so off base. Okay, there was a need to express more opinions, I think. Okay, but the point is, the news we get, no matter who's giving it to us, be it Fox, be it MSNBC, is filtered for us. It's filtered by editorial.
Right.
They make the choice of what they're going to put on there. Okay, I mean, just last week at Fox,
mm-hmm.
instead of running Christopher Wray's testimony about the January 6th insurrection, they ran articles about that dropping Dr. Seuss. Okay, the books. Okay, that's an editorial decision. All right, it's a filtered news system, and everybody
mm-hmm.
does the same thing. I'm just using that as the example there.
Yeah.
Okay. My question, which is, I'm doing what's called circumlocution. I'm asking things too long away. Okay. The word unfiltered, is that bad? Maybe that's the word we have to work on. Okay. And how do we change them? Teach them to create their own filters. Pat, there you go.
And I think you're absolutely right. It becomes about teaching them to create their own filters. It's why, the work that we are doing at Driving Force is focused on getting learners to think like historians. And that means creating those sorts of filters. We focus on the notion of untold moments in history, because those are moments that are relatively unfiltered. It's not something that has been presented to you through a traditional textbook.
It's a great point.
Not a story that you've heard vetted through others. And I think you're right. You watch
That's a great point.
Of the news, and we all know. I mean, the news is packaged both in terms of what is most important to those viewers and what's going to sell. So what you get on Fox is going to be a different perspective than what you get on MSNBC. And it's filtered in terms of what the advertisers want to be seeing, which is related. When I talk about news being unfiltered, I mean, it's fascinating when you watch young people and you see – the events of January 6th, for instance, as they were watching that happen in real time, and they were watching, non-educator, non-news people, TikTok influencers who are simply showing, live clips of what was happening in Washington, D.C. at the Capitol, and were really offering their emotion at the time without offering anything around it. But at the same time, I mean, my daughter's 13. When she was 12, she had expressed concerns because she had one friend that the only thing she was putting on Snap and TikTok were Trump news clips from Fox or Newsmax.
Well,
kids are sophisticated in terms of how they consume information.
Yep.
And they do look to those, influencers on social media as a guide. But those influencers are often uneducated in a lot of this and aren't providing their own filters because they don't get it.
Yeah.
And so it really does become, it's one of those, my aspiration is for each one of these. We use the videos to start discussions. Every one of our videos ends with a question that's meant for classroom discussion. But, you know, I would simply be happy if every time, you know, a young person is introduced to a new artifact of history, a new person in history, a new event that they had never heard of, is, you know, they start every time they're told something, they just ask why. They just keep asking why until they're getting enough information to begin to create that filter for themselves to know, is this significant to me or not?
Give an example of an untold story that you like, your favorite or whatever.
I named one of them for you. I think that, you know, the Samuel J. Tilden, years and years ago,
oh, okay.
I once did an interview where, you know, somebody had asked, because I'm the son, as we've talked about, I'm the son of a college president. And they asked who my favorite president was. And my immediate response was, and my favorite elected president was Samuel J. Tilden. That was
great.
One of my favorite things. I think, you know, we've done
That's
a
great.
Couple of videos that, you know, and I think that I would point to, you know, one is, I think most, I shouldn't make this assumption, many who know the Civil War have heard of John Brown.
Sure.
You know, the absolutely nutty abolitionist.
Yeah.
And I know that Ethan Hawke just did a movie that was on
was great.
HBO or something last year.
Let me correct you. It was a series,
okay, series
on Showtime, and it was called The Good Lord Byrd. And I do suggest people watch that. It was really excellent, I thought. But you, please go ahead.
No, and I used to, when we lived in West Virginia, I remember visiting many times the John Brown Museum in Harper's Ferry, which is where he plotted a lot of this and led some of his insurrections.
Yeah.
But as you know, we've been working with educators in Kentucky to tell Kentucky's role in American history.
Yep.
And we have this great video about essentially the bayonets that John Brown created to arm former slaves in part of the insurrection, and that he had to do it because it was illegal to provide guns to former slaves in Kentucky. So he created these bayonets, and there are still some of them around today. They were used during Reconstruction as warnings to politicians. They would be sent these things. You can still see them in some of the museums down there. You know, that I love those sorts of stories.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know, we have another video, you know, as part of, as we look at the role of women in history, you know, we have one about Mercy Otis Warren, who was one of the harshest critics against the founding fathers and the creation of this new nation. You never hear her story. When we hear about women during the American Revolution, it's pretty much Betsy Ross and Abigail Adams, and that's it.
I was just going to say, yeah.
Mercy Otis Warren's story is far more interesting.
Right. And it's great stuff. The history is a patchwork. And it's what the historians conclude you need to know. But kids need to know they can be their own historian. People need to know they can be their own historians. It's the little stuff to me. And I always use the example of this. Okay, there was a movie it's not American history. There was a movie a few years ago that Colin Firth won the Oscar for, called The King's Speech. Do you remember that movie, Pat?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
A lifelong stutterer, it is an important movie to me, yes.
Well, I did not know you stuttered, and good luck with that. You don't sound it at all. Most people do grow out of stuttering, as a matter of fact, with a little bit of patience and good fortune and good therapy. But this man had to address the nation. And if he were a stutterer, he was a stutterer, but if he did not say the speech correctly on the radio address, King George VI, I think, okay, if he didn't do that, okay, the nation would have thought, who is this guy? How can we stand behind him? So it's a little story, but it's a big chunk of history, okay? And that's the kind of thing, although it's hardly a two-minute video, okay? To me, that's what history really is. And, you know, when you talk about the disputed election of 76, Samuel Tilden Rutherford, or rather, should I say, Rutherford B. Hayes, okay, as you well know, he used to be nicknamed, okay, the point is the history is made up of little stories, okay, like your life is, okay, and if you take the time to do that, you understand where this country was all along. To me, the whole thing is just more fascinating the deeper and deeper you go in it. I want to ask you one more thing because we got about 5 minutes left, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And you wrote this okay? But I don't see it quite this way, so I'm going to use your quote. What are the battles between history versus civics? I don't see it per se as a battle, but I was curious why you use that word.
I think one of the challenges we have is we have folks who use many of these terms differently. And I think, you know, we've seen in many places where people have talked about civics, you're seeing it more a focus not on civics in the government sense, but we're seeing it civics in terms of the activism sense. That does, and I think we've seen this across the country, as we've seen in communities where they talk about the importance of teaching civics, is that's immediately being seen by some corners of our society as teaching civic activism. As a result, what we see is we see a shutdown. We see those who are saying we should not be teaching civics in government anymore. That's wrong. We should only be teaching the tried and true histories that we've once had. And I think that is creating issues for us. I think, when you have, the notion we don't necessarily understand what civics means. And as a result, it goes to the filter question you were asking. We see civics, we define it based on our own experiences. One can and should make the case that when we're talking about the teaching of the social studies, we're talking about effectively teaching history and government and civics and economics. But it can often be hard to separate those pieces. And as a result, I think, we see civics. And so for those who will say we don't need civics, I mean, yes, I can make the argument that based on the last year, based on civic activism, based on, all of the protests that we've had, based on voter turnout, that young people truly understand their civic rights today. They might have issues with some of them. They might have issues with some states that are trying to turn them back. But they understand their civic voice and understand their role in civic society. But it becomes enormously concerning if, as you articulated at the beginning of this program, if you don't have the foundational knowledge, if you don't understand the history, you don't understand, how this government was created and those documents that established it, then you're only going into the battle half prepared. And I think that's my biggest concern.
Right. And it's so interesting. You can take it back again. We go back to that 1619 thing. You have to understand, the formation of those documents over years of history. Okay. When black people, African people, were called 3/5 of a person for voting. Give me a break.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, mm-hmm. It's beyond common. You say the words, you can't even believe you're saying them. Okay, and how does that happen?
Yeah,
because they were there. They came over here as enslaved people. It's unbelievable. Okay,
It is. And I think when you look at it, it's when I talk about the totality of the social studies. You want to talk about the 1619 project going through Reconstruction. And, the impact of slavery on this country and on its economy. And, if you're going to have the argument as to whether the Civil War was simply about slavery or not. In order to truly have that sort of thoughtful discussion, you also have to understand economics.
That's right.
Of that discussion. You can't just have it be an emotional discussion.
I got to tell you, Pat, you'll love this, and you probably know it, my favorite goofy story. Of talk about crazy little untold history. You always say Eli Whitney invented the cotton gin.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. One of the reasons he invented the cotton gin, and by the way, picking cotton can be very painful because it's very prickly and you have to pull the cotton off the bowl type of thing. Okay. And it's off the bowl, but it's tough on your hands. And he invented the cotton gin, a machine to do that, hoping that would end slavery, that there would be no need to have slaves because a machine would do their work. Okay, that's one of the reasons he invented the machine. It turns out that in those days, I think it's around 1820 or so, cotton had really dropped on the international market. Okay, and it was too expensive to pick. And slavery was in and of itself dying as a cotton picking thing. Okay, because the cotton wasn't worth what it was. With the invention of the cotton gin, it brought up the price of cotton and made it much easier to pick it. Okay, and as a result, cotton became king again. Okay, so here is inadvertent history. Eli Whitney, a man who's trying to create a machine, okay, to start to help end slavery, creates the machine that in fact makes it all the more worthwhile. It's just a weird little quirk of history. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's the beauty of history. That's all. And that's what history's made up of. I think that's when we talk about how contradictory and complex and all that history is, those are the sorts of stories that once you understand it, I mean, you go down the rabbit hole. You want to learn more.
It is a rabbit hole. It is a rabbit hole, my friend. We got to leave this particular rabbit hole because we are running out of time, old buddy.
Well, I appreciate it, Larry. Thanks so much.
I love talking to you. You want to do more? We'll do more. How's that sound? I love talking to you.
Sounds good to me.
Okay, thanks, pal. This is great. Tell everybody the website again, Pat. Driving Force Institute. Go ahead,
DrivingForceInstitute.org and UntoldHistory.org.
It's good stuff, everybody. Check it out and make it interdisciplinary, and I love it. That's Pat Rickards. Thank you, Pat.
Thank you.
Be good, buddy. Have a good week. Thank you. Bye-bye. Pat Rickards, everybody, Driving Force Institute. Okay, we'll archive over at ace-ed.org. We got to go. We're running out of time. My name is Larry Jacobs. This is Pre-K-12 Education Talk Radio. Thanks for listening.